from all of us at Life Between the Vines, happy holidays to our loyal listeners. We all love to celebrate the holidays with family, food, friends, and most of all, wine. So with that in mind, we celebrate our 103rd podcast with Women in the Wine Industry, featuring excerpts from previous programs dating back to 2010, with Carissa Mondavi of Continuum Estate, Linda Neal of Tierra Roja Vineyard and Winery, Karen Cakebread of Ziada Wines, and Amy Aiken of Meander Wines. Here's wishing everyone a very happy and healthy New Year. In June of 2011, during Auction Napa Valley, I had the great pleasure to meet and talk with Marcia Mondavi about Continuum Estate, the winery she owns with her brother, Tim Mondavi. In early October, I met with Tim's daughter, Carissa Mondavi, at Continuum Estate on Pritchard Hill. And the thing I first noticed about Carissa was she has her grandfather's eyes. And when you've met second and third generation winemakers in Napa Valley, you almost begin to wonder if passion for wine is printed on their DNA. But when you see the joy that comes out in conversation, you know exactly how sincerely they care for their art and craft. Carissa has the pleasure of joining her siblings, as well as her father and aunt, on creating this new wine in the Napa Valley market. And from what I've tasted, they've done very well. I guess this would be the Continuum Estate, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, great. And I'm here with Carissa Mondavi. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks. How are you doing?
Good. It's exciting to talk to you. The last name, of course, if one or two people might be familiar with your family line, and your dad is Tim Mondavi.
Yes.
Who is, of course, son to Robert Mondavi.
Yes.
And your aunt is Marcia, who we talked to during the auction.
Mm-hmm.
And what a great history you've got.
Yeah, I mean, we're, as a family, very proud of everything that we've been able to accomplish. Obviously, everything that's brought us to where we are today.
It's like, well, wine is a very much a family thing. What our goal at Life Between the Vines is just simply making wine less scary. So that's our approach.
It's yeah. Fun. No, I worked at a wine shop in San Francisco. It's called the Jug Shop, and the wine buyer there, when I first sat down, we had an espresso met before I was officially working with him, and he said, you know what, I'm going to treat the person buying, you know, the box wine the same as the person who's going to be buying your dad's Cabernet Reserve. And I was like, this is where I want to work. And it was like, I love that spirit of wine, because I think that real wine and passion and the wine culture really is about being accessible, being the spirit of generosity, you know, being able to share.
And there is that great spirit of generosity, which just knocks my socks off here. So let's talk about you specifically, and then we'll talk about Continuum. Obviously, you're in this wine family. Gosh, I don't know. Was there pressure to be involved in it? Was it just all of a sudden you had a moment? How did this come to be?
You know, I get that question a lot. I think, like, my grandfather's story, my great-grandfather's story, and is just as much about the American dream as it is specific to wine. And so we were always encouraged to pursue our passions, whatever they were. And yet there was always, you know, but I think you'll find once you have a passion for great wine, that never goes away. Once you have a passion for great food and great wine, that never goes away. So then it just becomes a matter of how it fits into your life. And so we were always encouraged to understand what we have here, like what we have here that is so special. And so I had other passions I pursued, and I always had one foot in wine, and somehow this was always just the thing that I was the most strongly drawn to and the most passionate about being able to share with others.
So did you grow up with it in your family? I mean, one thing I remember reading, and I did read your grandfather's book, and I think he said something in there about his mother putting a little bit of wine in his espresso, which doesn't really sound very appealing, by the way.
Well, my grandfather would say that he would, you know, I asked him that once because I would hear stories when I would be traveling of these things my grandfather would do. And I asked him, I said, do you put wine in your coffee? He's like, I like to put a little bit of red wine in coffee when I'm having a greasy breakfast. It cuts through the grease. It was all about pairing, you know?
That makes a lot of sense if you think about it.
Yeah.
I've never tried it myself. I mean, yeah. Closest I get is, you know, Bailey's or something like that.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried anything like that?
I actually, no, have not. Maybe I really should.
Maybe you should at least be able to say you've had the experience, and then after that, you'll never do it again.
I know. If it's calling for alcohol for breakfast, I generally go for mimosas or Bloody Marys, but I don't know what I've been missing with this red wine and coffee. I should try.
I think
it's very Italian.
Oh, yeah.
But they do say for winemakers, it's better to taste in the morning because your palates are fresher.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, let's talk about your role here at the winery, at Continuum. What is your role here?
Well, we are tiny. Continuum is just now, our first handful of vintages were about 1,500 cases. We're just now growing into more like 2,200 with the release of our 09, which is coming up in March.
What year would that have been, the 1,500?
That was 05 and 06. Our first vintage was 05. I mean, the name Continuum speaks to the fact that as a family, we have not missed a harvest since 1919, but we've gone from grape shipping and to bulk wine with the repeal of Prohibition in 1933 to varietal wine at Charles Krug Winery, to focus on fine wine at Robert Mondavi Winery in 1966, to now with Continuum, it's the 2005 was the first vintage. My dad's last wine at Robert Mondavi Winery was the 2004 Cabernet Sauvignon Reserve. He did stay on to consult on that wine. So, yeah, that's what Continuum means. But my point being that we're very small, and it's all hands on deck, and obviously this is a project very close to my family's hearts. I mean, this is how we will carry forward as a family in wine, and so we're all very involved in all the decisions. So I my role has been hospitality, PR, marketing, sales. I'm in the market showing the wine. I'm here developing the materials, the communication, all of that. I mean, we're all extremely involved. But very simply, I am doing everything I can. I want to tell my dad's story. I think he's a tremendous winemaker, and this is his time. This is, Continuum is an expression of his vision.
I like that. This is his time. When you look at, obviously, your grandfather, and now it's his time, you're carrying on this family tradition. And yeah, you're right. I totally forgot about your great-grandfather. I slipped my mind. Imagine that. You're involved with a lot of what's going on. Is it sort of like a partnership? I mean, I don't want to bring an age thing into it, but how does that work?
Continuum is, this is my father and my aunt carrying on in wine in our families, and so we're all very involved. But my father was the winemaker at Robert Mondavi Winery for over 30 years, and so this is an expression of his vision. I mean, very much my aunt's vision as well, but this is a winemaker's estate, so that is what is really hard driving the decisions that we're making. And as a family, we have never done what we're doing now. I mean, it's the groundwork of my great-grandfather and my grandfather that have laid the path for us to be able to do this, but because Continuum is one wine from one estate. This is a winemaker's estate. And so this is our commitment to realizing the best of our family's legacy and having something that is recognized among the great estates in wine.
So let's talk about Continuum and what you're making. Obviously, we're drinking a cab. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what we're drinking right now?
This is it. This is everything. I mean, Continuum is the one wine that we are focused on. And when everything changed at the end of 04, my dad evaluated what is it that is that you see in places that can endure. I mean, this is the third time we've recreated ourselves in a way. My dad refers to this as our fifth beginning, going back to shipping grapes to bulk wine. But my grandfather, when he's, it was not by his choice to separate from Charles Krug Winery, but then he created something great and that was relevant to his day, you know, and he'd had 30 years of experience by the time he started Robert Mondavi Winery. It's sort of the same case with Continuum. My dad was the same age at 53 years old that my grandfather was when we started Continuum. And we're creating something that is relevant to today. I mean, the first vintage of Opus 1 was the 79 vintage and it was 2,000 cases. And they didn't release it until they released the 1980 vintage, because, and they released them at the same time because they felt 2,000 cases was too small to make an impact. And today it's very different. Our closest neighbors are selling, you know, 500 cases, and it's a very different world today. I mean, so we are creating something that is relevant to today. We can do this today because of what has come before. And when my dad would evaluate, he said, you know, the places that endure are self-contained estates where you develop teams that are committed to those vines day in and day out, year after year, and they know them so intimately that they can master the proper balance in the vineyards and have that convey through to the wine. And And it is about having absolute clarity of focus. So one wine from one estate. That's what we're doing today. And this particular one is 71% Cabernet Sauvignon, 17% Cabernet Franc, 7% Petit Verdot, and 5% Merlot. And again, 70% coming from this estate. Ultimately, we'd like to see a much higher percentage of Cabernet Franc, because Cabernet Franc is sensational up here. And probably in the future, you'll see a little less Cabernet Sauvignon.
Do you think there'd be a time you'd ever just bottle a Cabernet Franc?
You know, I think my, who knows? You never know. I wouldn't want to limit us or what we can do, but
Well, there's kind of a growing contingent of people who are making just Cabernet Franc, which I think is pretty gutsy.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that's not a hit record right away for a lot of people.
Up here, though, it's pretty hard to refute. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary up here. So I think that anyone who maybe had historically not been a fan of Cabernet Franc would probably have a different feeling for the kind of Cabernet Franc you see up here.
Growing up in this family, and obviously you grew up here. I don't know what part of Napa specifically you grew up in, but you're growing up around wine all the time. Was there a time where it just became wine, you know?
Not for me. I grew up frolicking in the mustard and, you know, that would grow between the vine rows in the springtime. And I, got to tromp through the vineyards. And I mean, I was very lucky. I would, climb the trees that were growing on the periphery of the vineyards. And, I loved it. I didn't know what we had until later. I mean, wine was always on the table. We always talked about it. I mean, I think one of the most empowering gifts my dad gave us was that he made it unintimidating. He never made it so precious that we couldn't, explore it. And he always validated our little palates. You know, he would, from the time I can remember, there would be wine on the table. We would be allowed to taste his wine. And on special occasions, we would have our own little glass and we would taste it. And he would ask us what we thought of the wine. And whatever our opinions were, we were never afraid to share them at that age, and he always validated our little palates. So it was never intimidating. It was a really natural way to, I think, grow up with it, where it wasn't so important growing up. It wasn't, we got to play in the vineyards, and I didn't steal as much wine as maybe I could have at that appropriate age. But I don't know. I think I never resented that. I also never grew up feeling like I was entitled to this great sort of legacy. I wasn't allowed to tromp through Robert Mondavi Winery like I owned the place. That was a very special place. I was wearing, I was in my best clothes, and we were all in our best behavior, and we knew how we were to handle ourselves. This was our dad's place of work, and and he would show us around from a young age. But I mean, it's not like we just had the run of the place. So I think maybe my parents kept us protected from what it could have been otherwise. But I grew up at the public school in Santa Elena, where my classmates' families owned wineries, and that was never something we all talked about. It was just how we made our living, And I don't think it was until after high school and even through and after college that we all started understanding a little more what it is, how special this valley is, And some of us chose to come back and be a part of it, and some... I think no matter what, if you come from Napa, you have an appreciation for what we have here and this bounty that is great food and great wine.
It's one of the best places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can you not want to come back to a place like this? And I've talked to plenty of winemakers' children
mm-hmm.
who've done this. I want to leave this country town, this backwater, whatever you want to call it. And then they come back with this love and appreciation thinking, where was my... But like anybody else, you move on. The reason I asked this question is simply because I've talked to so many winemakers about when they have kids. Would you like to hand it down to your kids? And every one of them uniformly have said, that's their decision. I'm not telling them to do it. If, sure, when they're kids, they do some of the labor, that kind of thing. But it's up to them to make that decision. How do you see that?
Oh, yeah, that was very much the way it was for us. I mean, I don't know. I don't think that's just specific to wine. I think that's sort of more the philosophy in general. Like allow people to pursue their passions, and so that is consistent with wine too. I think maybe there was a time when you were expected to carry on in it, but But, you know, I mean, I don't know any different. So I feel really lucky that I get to drive here and come to work and I get to share this with people. It is, my grandfather always used to say, you find a job you love, you never work a day in your life. And that is the way that it is in wine, I think. And I think you have a lot of people who gravitate towards it. And I mean, but the truth is, it is a lot of hard work, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's 24/7. It's different. You have different things that you're, but that you are maybe sort of carrying. We're very lucky.
Well, creating a painting is hard work too. It's just a matter of
my sister. My sister is an artist, and there's a whole thing that goes with that. I mean, and yet it's such an exquisite expression that she excels at so beautifully for the time she devotes to it.
Well, I like that saying though. It's the same thing. If you find something you love, you're right. He's right. You'll never work a day in your life. Mm-hmm. Turn a corner here a little bit. From a woman's point of view, we've talked about this with a few winemakers. I've interviewed a lot of female winemakers in the Valley, and it's really impressive to me how many women are becoming winemakers because, you know, it's physically a very demanding job, let alone the hours you put into it. But there's been talk occasionally that women have a finer, maybe, I don't know if I'd say more developed palate. Do you have an opinion on that? I've heard plenty of men say that's how they understand it.
My dad says that.
Yeah?
Yeah. My dad says that that women do have better palates. But he's certainly been in far more tasting rooms with women winemakers and than I ever have. So I trust his sense. So yeah, I would think so. I don't know why that is, though. That's an interesting thing. I'm sure there's a scientific, you know, reason for that. And I don't know why that is, but that's what it seems to be the case. Well, I think, you know, it's... wine is so complex, and I think obviously the biggest thing that's going to help you understand it is just drinking more. Just the more you drink, the more you'll understand, and the more refined your palate becomes. And I think my father has one of the most extraordinary palates out there. I mean, it is so fascinating to sit down with him because he will taste something in a wine and he'll be able to reference, you know, a vintage 20 years before and what happened there. And I mean, as we're going through blending the wines, there's so many things that he's done and that he's seen the results from, and or that he will decide to do that he knows where it will take us. You know, it's just based, and he has very specific points in history and wines that he's done that he references with that. And he's a master in his own right now, and I think it's to me it's extraordinary to watch. And I think, I mean, it really speaks to the fact that the more you do, the more you understand, the more you know, the more you understand the nuances within it, the complexities within it.
I think it's great how excited you get talking about your dad. That's very impressive. Does this whole concept of Bordeaux and the fact that you talked about a budget, you have a budget, I have a budget, mm-hmm. that's just not in our reach. Yeah. Does that frustrate you?
That's interesting because I know what goes into making it. So I think there's something to be said for having something that is special that you have on very special occasions that you share with people, that I think there's a time and a place for it, because I absolutely do splurge, but I'm just saying it's not what I'm drinking on, it's not on my table every night, but it is, I do splurge for special occasions.
I guess I'm thinking more of a first growth that would be, you know, I mean, you're talking four figures here.
Yeah, no, I know. It's something to marvel at, I would say. It's pretty incredible what's happening. And that's great that there's such a market. I mean, the truth is, you know, when my grandfather started Robert Mondavi Winery, first gross were selling for $5 a bottle. So it was a very different, that was in 1966. So it has been a dramatic shift. And I think that just speaks to the fact that there's this great appreciation for artistic wines. And I would have never think, no, absolutely, that's terrible. Who do they think they are selling them at that price? If there's a market for it, why shouldn't they?
If people are going to pay it, right, I can't argue with that. It's just sort of, most little folk don't get to drink it.
That's, I know, the drag. Right? Well, on occasion, I think on a few glorious occasions, hopefully, if we focus enough, we can.
Or if we play our cards right.
Right.
Yeah. In the right place at the right time.
I wouldn't rule it out. You can certainly access those wines. No, I think wine, again, I keep saying this, but wine is about sharing. It's about bringing people closer together. So in all the iterations within wine, I think express that too.
If our listeners want to find out more about Continuum on the web, how would they do that?
Well, we have a website, so we have a lot of information on our website. So it's www.continuumestate.com.
Excellent. And if perchance they wanted to call the winery, because is there somebody they could ask questions? Do you do that?
Absolutely. We have a mailing list. I mean, they could speak to Lindsay, and they could even come see us here. So yeah, you can call here at the estate. The number is 707-944-8100.
Excellent. This has been a complete pleasure talking to you. You're absolutely charming and you got a great sense of humor, but more importantly, you're a real person, and that's great. And I think hopefully people will listen and understand that and maybe try some Continuum.
Well, thank you. And thank you for your interest in what we're doing. My goodness. I mean, truly, thank you for taking all the time that taken with me.
This is more fun than I can tell you. Again, I'm stopping the tape.
Okay.
Find out more about Continuum on the web at continuumestate.com. Traveling along Silverado Trail, you'll pass wineries of all different types, sizes, and structures, with many that are highly visible and some that are integrated with the scenery. You'd never know just how many individual vineyard owners and small wine producers you'll also pass by. Tierra Roja is one of those vineyards. Linda Neal, owner of Tierra Roja, makes an exceptional wine from her 4-acre vineyard on Silverado Trail, located right next to her own home. I interviewed Linda a few days before the premier Napa Valley event on a rare, warm, and sunny February day. We talked, we tasted, and Linda even taught me how to prune. I'm here with Linda Neal of Tierra Roja. Am I getting the name right?
That's right.
Nice that I get it right for a change. And we're on Silverado Trail, literally about 50 feet at most away from the door here. So tell me, according to what I saw, you started Tierra Roja in 2007?
Well, that's not quite right. So I've actually been farming here since 87, and actually began making wine in 2003, and then began selling wine in 2007. So part of it was correct.
Are you distributing in any way, or is it strictly here in Napa?
Well, it's available primarily on my website, but also it is distributed in a few major cities, available in some nice restaurants and a few of the wine shops. So a little diversity.
All this time growing, what made you decide you wanted to go ahead and make your own?
I used to be in the vineyard management business for over 20 years, and so I had a pretty big company, and I was too busy with that business. And so when I retired from that back in 07, something that I had always wanted to do was have my own wine instead of always contributing to other people's wines, and that was the reason.
So where did the name come from?
The name actually came from the workers. All of our workers here at my old vineyard management company are Mexican citizens, and they all speak Spanish. And they had a Spanish nickname for every one of our ranches. So the ranch of the cow was Rancho de la Vaca. The ranch that had the teepee on it was Rancho de los Indios, Casablanca, and so on. And they always referred to this as the ranch of the red earth. Because when we cut the terraces, it was just this blazing volcanic red soil.
So that's quite an honor to be named by your workers like that.
Yes, and so it was kind of interesting. We had always called the ranch that, and we had a sign out front. And when we decided to create a wine, I was told by a number of people that, a Spanish name, that's going to be a real uphill battle for marketing a quality wine. And I said, well, that might be, but that's the name. It's been the name for over 20 years. I'm not going to change it now.
Are you the sole owner, or do you have partners in this venture, or?
I'm the sole owner. It's actually, the winemaking operation is actually a corporation, so I get to be a CEO. But I'm sole owner of the vineyard.
The property, how many acres do you have here?
Well, I have about 7.5 acres, and about 4.25 of that are planted to grapevines.
Okay, and you're primarily or completely Cabernet?
Completely Cabernet up almost completely Cabernet. There's actually 30 vines of Petit Verdot, but they don't go into my wine. They go to a friend of mine. It's a long story. I'll shorten it though. I planted them for a man that was buying grapes from me. And then our relationship ended. And so I had 30 vines of Petit Verdot that couldn't go into my blend. And that the buyer of my other Cabernet was not interested in. And I have a really good friend, Scott Tracy, who just started his own wine label. He's a sommelier at Le Toque Restaurant. And so I said, hey, I heard you say you wanted a little bit of Petit Verdot. So that's, you know, I just gave those to him.
What do you get? What kind of a yield do you get from 30 vines?
Oh, like 100 pounds. No, more than that. I'll show you a picture of the stack. You know, it's like a stack of boxes that high and that wide. You can fit it all in a back of a pickup truck. Petit Verdot is a very strong flavored grape, and so a tiny amount will really give an interesting spice to a blend of wine.
What are you blending with?
I don't blend with anything. Mine is 100% Cabernet Sauvignon.
So you're 100%, and it's 100%, can we call it estate? Is that fair to say that?
Yes, absolutely.
What got you into the wine business in the beginning, way back when you started?
Well, you'd have to go all the way back to high school. I was involved in Future Farmers and agriculture in high school, but I did not grow up on a farm, so I didn't have that farming background. And so looking for my avenue into agriculture, which I just found to be an exciting and interesting field, I went into sales and I actually sold agricultural chemicals for a French company. And I serviced all of Northern California, including the Napa Valley. So that's how I first started coming here. And I was working with grape growers in this area with fungicides. And in the process of doing that, I fell in love with my then-to-be future husband and gave up that business and moved here to the Napa Valley. And that's when we started the Vineyard Management Company, which had been a lifelong dream of his, and did that with him for over 20 years. And then, sadly, a divorce came along, and so he took the Vineyard Management Company, and I started over with the vineyards. So that's how the wine business came about.
Are you happy with what you've done so far with this?
Yes, I'm very happy because it ties in with my love of the vineyard. The wine business is really like starting over. It's nothing like the vineyard business. It's completely different people. And it was a little bit of a surprise to me of how much it would be starting from scratch. But all of the people that I've met are really interesting, and they love wine, and they love their experience with the Napa Valley. So that part has really been fun. I'm very fortunate that I work with an outstanding winemaker who makes a very high quality wine for me. That was always a criteria. It had to be something of the highest quality, or it just wasn't going to be fun. After being a vineyard manager for so long, there just really was no other way to go.
And who is your winemaker?
David DeSante. Actually, David and Catherine. It's a husband and wife team, and just fantastic young couple. They have their own DeSante brand as well. Can't say enough good things about those folks.
And are they right here in the valley, or?
Yes, they're here in St. Helena.
I saw your label, and I felt that your label is a very classic looking label, very classy looking as well. What brings you to your decision, especially when you're such a small grower? That's your heart right there. So how do you arrive at that?
Well, that was really hard. It was one of the hardest things that I've ever had to do, because when you decide, that's it, you know, this is how I'm going to represent myself to everyone. And you might say you can't tell a book by the cover, but what else do people have to go by? And it was extremely hard. And if it were left up to me, I would have probably never decided on one. But David and Catherine called me up one day and they said, we will be there at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. You need to pick one. And I had already worked with two designers, and the first designer just didn't get me at all. The second designer, we worked a long time back and forth, and when she finally gave me what I asked for, I didn't like it. Had to start over from scratch again. One of the versions, Jennifer Lamb said, looked like a label for a tequila. And it went on and on. It was extremely difficult. But what I wanted to get across was the love of the history of the property, the love of farming and yet the fact that it's an elegant wine. So trying to combine the love of the earth with a high quality product, and that's that. Those are two difficult things to marry sometimes.
And I want to say, as I came to your door, you were out in the vineyard. There was a note on the door saying that you're out there, which I think is neat, just the idea that you're out there on an incredibly beautiful day getting this opportunity to spend with your vines. It's got to be a lot better than the normal pruning in wintertime, I would imagine.
Oh, it's so gorgeous, so gorgeous. And we just have to savor these moments because we know by the end of the week it'll be raining again, and it's actually much better for the vines to prune in warm, dry weather as well. There's less problems with disease incidents if you can prune in warm, dry weather. So we wait until the last possible moment. It's a small place, so I can do that. Larger operations cannot. But if I had my way, I'd wait till March 1st, but then I only have one guy helping me and we wouldn't get it done, so...
So there's two of you doing all the pruning.
That's right. That's right. Now, we do bring in other people to help us with some operations that we can't get done between the two of us. But we not only have this vineyard, we have another vineyard in the Sierra foothills that we travel back and forth to take care of. So we get spread kind of thin and sometimes need some outside help.
Sure. About how far away is that?
Well, it's about 2.5 hours.
Are you from California originally? It sounds like you are.
Yes. Pasadena.
Okay. Oh, big difference. So, not exactly a farm girl, obviously.
No, as I moved to farming country at the beginning of high school, and it was really like moving to a foreign country, but I embraced it. I loved it. I had to find my way to become a farmer. And the ag teacher said, well, you have to marry it or inherit it. And it turns out that neither was my avenue in. My avenue in was management, working for other people. So that's how I got to enter this beautiful world.
So do you take time to try your neighbor's wines and compare what they're doing to say what you're doing, or just to simply look at them on their own and see how they stand? Do you ever do that?
Yes. What time is it? Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm very fortunate to be a member of the Oakville Wine Growers Association and the Napa Valley Vintners Association. And both of those groups get together regularly and everybody brings a bottle of their finest and everybody gets to share. So that's done on a regular basis. And then sometimes just one-on-one.
And as I recall with your note, this is going to be your first appearance at Premier Napa Valley. Is that right?
That's right.
So you got to be pretty excited about that.
I'm really excited. I have no idea what to expect.
Well, we'll see you there.
From what I understand, it's going to be crazy. There's 500 guests plus, I don't know, maybe 200 wineries pouring, let's just say. I don't really know. And, you know, a couple of people for each winery. And I think it's going to get pretty crazy. It's inside the CIA, which is an old stone building. I bet it's going to rock, actually.
I want to get off the beaten path just a little bit with a question I've asked every owner winemaker I've met. How do you feel about corks versus screw caps?
I don't feel strongly one way or the other. I think both closures have their benefits, and I think it should probably depend a lot on the wine itself. If it's a wine that's going to be drunk relatively soon, such as a Sauvignon Blanc, I think that there's a lot of benefits to the screw cap. If the wine is exactly the way you want it when you put it in the bottle, you want something that seals that well. But red wines are usually designed to breathe and mature over time. They're not at their peak when they're bottled. And so in those cases, there's advantages to the cork. So, and I'm sure new types of enclosures are going to perhaps even offer more exciting ideas. I have my distributor in Chicago is also a guy that invents things on the side, and he and a friend of his are working on a product that's a cork with a special type of treatment that has actually, I don't even know how it works, but it's designed to open up when you want it to. Let's say if you want that wine to get more air a year from now, it does that. I don't have any idea how that's going to work, but I know that creative people are just going to keep improving on what we have now.
So what is your goal for Tierra Roja?
My goal with the wine is to bring people here to Tierra Roja, to try and create a wine that gives people a sense of place. If they can come here and visit me, that's fabulous. But if they're not able to do that, perhaps they can do it with a glass of the wine. And that's really the goal of this wine.
So you'll take people here, just like you're seeing me for the interview, by appointment, and spend time with them here in your home?
I will invite people into my home and spend time with them here or in the vineyard. Unfortunately, because of county regulation, I'm not allowed to do wine tastings and pourings here. I cannot do sales from here. So most people want to have a wine experience that includes drinking the wine. But some people are just interested in the vineyard and meeting a vintner. That I'm happy to do. I'm very available. I do put on vineyard clinics for people that want to come out and do that at pruning time and in the spring. And again, it's a way of sharing my blessed life in this beautiful place with other people.
And it is a beautiful place. It's just to see the hill right behind us looking out your back windows. It's very, very nice. Are you comfortable with the size? Do you think you'll ever want to grow a little bit bigger, or just want to kind of keep it to a nice little operation that you can keep your hands on?
This wine will never be more than 250 cases. Oh, and I don't say never. Never say never. It is my goal to keep it 250 cases forever. I want it to be something that's special, a special occasion wine. And it's a very expensive wine to produce. So with all new French oak and barrel fermentation, a lot of very expensive procedures. And so it's at $115 a bottle, it's not something that most people are going to pop open every day. And when you grow and you try to get bigger and bigger and bigger, it's very, very difficult to reproduce that kind of quality on a large scale. And so if I get the urge to make more wine, I'll make a different wine, but it won't be this one. This one will always be special.
And I just want to go back to, you said barrel fermentation. Not a lot of folks are doing that here. Tell me about your approach to that. Why did you choose to do barrel fermentation?
I didn't choose. The winemaker chose. And my idea is, I know a lot about the vineyards, but I am not knowledgeable in winemaking. So I hired the person I considered to be the most talented that I had met and worked with. And I said, well, you know, we need a really great wine. I want something really special. Pull out all the stops, do whatever it takes. And that was his approach, amongst many other things. David DeSanti has a philosophy. You can make soup two ways. You can either boil the bones all day on the stove, or you can melt down a bouillon cube. Either way, you get a bouillon. But which is going to taste better? And David always does things in the way that's going to give you that really homemade taste.
Well, I think you succeeded, because this is a wonderful wine. Thank you for pouring for me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Where can our listeners find Tierra Roja?
Well, listeners can go to my website, which is www.tierraroja.com, and learn more about how they can get the wine.
That's great. Linda, thanks very, very much for your time on this incredibly beautiful day. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ray. You know, as a small winemaker, this is very exciting, and I appreciate you being here.
This is the end of part one of podcast 103. Download part two from lifebetweenthevines.com or from iTunes.